Binge-watching TV is a widespread practice. For those of you who may not know, it means watching two or three or four episodes of a show all at once. So you're committing 2 or 3 or 4 hours, depending on if it's an hour-length show, to watch something in a binge kind of format. For instance, if you're into the British shows, for instance, you really maybe like The Crown, and you are watching something about the 1950s and 60s Queen of England. And you see her in every single episode, but there are all different kinds of characters coming in and out. There are different plot lines going on in every single show. And so even though you have the same show and the same main character, there are all different kinds of ideas floating through there, and the same show, same objective, same message. Maybe you're into sitcoms, and maybe you like something like Last Man Standing, and you see the same show, the same message, the same objective, but you're always going to get Tim Allen's sarcasm. I mean, that's going to be the centerpiece of all things when it comes to understanding what this show is all about, even though there might be different plot lines. Well, we are about to binge watch Mark. Chapter 7, verse 24, through chapter 8 and verse 10 are three separate episodes. Same message, same character, same major person, obviously Jesus, but there are different kinds of things that are lining up here to make this particular point that Jesus is going to make this morning. So if you would watch with me, binge watch with me, Mark chapter 7, verses 24 through chapter 8 and verse 10, and see how Jesus is showing the gospel. Mark chapter 7 and verse 24 in the English Standard Version. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. He'd entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. Immediately a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first. It's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home, found the child lying in bed. The demon was gone. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of Decapolis. And there they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears and, after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking to heaven, he sighed and said, "Ephtha," that is, "be open." And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one, but the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond all measure, saying, "He's done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, "I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from far away." And his disciples answered him, "How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place?" And he asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set before the crowd, and there they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said that these too should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away, and immediately got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. Many of you know that I'm involved with a group on the campus of IUPUI called the Comenius Institute. And one of the things that the board of the Comenius Institute and I agreed to is that I would go back to school. And so I am back in school again, having now, over the last few years, accrued about 22 master's credit hours in English and literature at IUPUI, having brilliant professors. I really do enjoy that and enjoy the opportunity, but it gives me then an opportunity to be with everybody and anybody, students and faculty across the campus. Well, in meeting with one of our Comenius students this week, it was interesting that we were having discussion about a lot of different things, and one of the things she asked me about, she said, you know, there are some groups on campus that really focus in a certain way on evangelism, and they practice evangelism in this certain way, and they are constantly talking with people. And she said, you know, I really struggle with that. I struggle with that because to me, evangelism is friendship. It's building relationships. She said, how do you do evangelism? And I smiled at her like I'm smiling at you now, and I said, I write really good academic papers. And she smiled and she said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, my professor does not care about John 3:16. My professor cares about the information she set before us and the readings and the papers that we're supposed to complete. And my job is to show the gospel through the kind of work that I do in the classroom. That's exactly what we're seeing in this passage of Scripture. Jesus is setting the example of showing the gospel. Now, everybody knows on the campus that is engaged in any way with me that I'm a Christian. That kind of just comes out, and every once in a while I actually get to share the gospel with people in a verbal way. But most of the time it's very visual. It's very much of a, you know, there's something different about this person. Well, that's exactly what's going on in here in this text. In the previous text, in Mark chapter 7, verses 1 to 23, there's an emphasis on the law and the intention of the law and keeping the law and the slavish conformity to all of the human regulations that were piled up on top of the law that God had already established. And the Jewish leaders were saying, you know what, if you don't keep things this way, if you don't keep the law this way, then you're really not a good Jew. You're really not following God. And of course, there's a great deal of emphasis in that passage on hypocrisy. Now, just a sidebar on hypocrisy. Be very careful about who you call a hypocrite, because as soon as you say that, you should probably go to the mirror in the bathroom like I do and look in the mirror and see one, because there he is. So, last week, David did a great job of emphasizing the Jewish emphasis of ceremonial cleansing. This is a very big deal for the Jewish population in Mark chapter 7, 1 to 23, and the emphasis on ritual washing. The Jewish leaders, of course, were twisting that particular law as if, as David suggested, if you bumped into an unclean person, a Gentile, then you had to go home and wash. In fact, there was even a Pharisaical sect that said that if the shadow of a Gentile fell on you, you were unclean and had to go home and take a bath. Imagine. This is exactly what's going on in the passage now, previous to us. And now we are engaging this showing the gospel issue because there's a whole different audience going on. Jesus flips the script. In the first 23 verses of Mark 7, he's telling people. In these verses, he's showing people the gospel. So, back to binge watching. We have three episodes in front of us, but one of the things that's really interesting about these three episodes is that there are five recurring themes running through them. Let me highlight some of those as we go here. The first one is about geography. Now, I realize that, you know, I stand in the presence of a man who loves to put maps on overheads, so, you know, I wanted to stay away from that this morning. But just to highlight the idea, this is a really important theme that runs through this passage. In 7:24, they begin, Jesus does, from Galilee and runs through Tyre and Sidon, and then coming all the way around to Decapolis toward the end of the chapter, or the end of this section in chapter 8. What's fascinating about this is if you take your car, get in your car, and you run from here to Purdue University, that's about 60 miles. And if you come back 120 miles, that amount of distance is exactly the distance that Jesus traveled in these verses right here. 120 miles from Galilee to Tyre to Sidon to Decapolis, gets in a boat, crosses, goes back over to the west coast, the Sea of Galilee. Now, there's really an important idea here. That is that we're looking at modern-day Lebanon and Syria, and we all know, if we know anything at all about the news, that there's all kinds of horrendous things going on in places like this. Most of it challenged over the ethnicity and international standards of people that can't get along. But it's outside of Jewish territory in this particular passage. That's the key to this. 15 times ahead of this passage, Jesus is teaching people in Galilee. He's teaching them, the Jews in Galilee. This is the very first time we find Jesus not teaching and not preaching. He is showing the gospel. And of course, he's doing this to Gentiles. Now, I got to say that we all like boundaries. And frankly, I do too. I love to stay in the lines. You know, those feel comfortable. But you know what? We're not here to feel comfortable. And that's exactly what Jesus does. He doesn't stay within the lines. He goes and ministers to people not like himself. So to be a Gentile, just to review, is anybody other than a Jew. And I suggest, by the way, that if I could cast a guess, there are no Jews here. We are all Gentiles. So this is the emphasis to us, that to the Jews, Jesus spoke of what they knew. They knew God's law. But to Gentiles, what does he do? He speaks to us of human life. What we all engage 24/7, 365, every single week, month, and year. So the idea here is one of Jesus' compassion. He's moved beyond boundaries. In fact, let me just put it to you this way. Jesus removed social boundaries simply by being in other social classes. I'll say that again. Jesus removes social boundaries simply by being with other social classes. Be with other people. The third idea of showing gospel is through miracles. Now, you've got three of them here. There's the casting out of the demon. There is the healing of the deaf, mute man. And then there's, of course, the feeding of thousands of people. There's no telling here. There's just doing. That's what Jesus is emphasizing. Now, what's really important to understand about this particular section is that during Jesus' days, there are a whole bunch of people running around doing magical stuff. They were actually called divine men. And these folks were actually doing miracles or something that appeared like miracles. And so if you read in Mark chapter 3 and Mark chapter 6, there's all kinds of this going on with Jesus. People are flocking to Jesus because he's healing people. Gee, wouldn't you too if you could get healed? Well, what Jesus is doing in terms of miracles is a whole bunch different than what everybody else was doing, which was false miracles. Jesus is doing the real thing. And what, of course, happens in every particular episode is that every episode here ends with a miracle. But what's even more important than that is the miracle that happens after the miracle. The changed life of an individual, changed because of what they have seen in Jesus, who shows the gospel. And what's really fascinating about this, all the way through Mark, is all the exclamations of people, starting in Mark chapter 1. You won't believe what Jesus just did. I just saw this down the road. There's a guy who just did this thing. I've never seen anything like it before. That's Jesus. And that is a miracle. There's another thing going on here, and that's secrecy. And in fact, it actually has something to do with the miracle bit. The secrecy issue is that Jesus is saying to people, don't tell anybody. Don't explain why. All the way through Mark, again, this is a major theme, 12 times I counted at least, where Jesus is telling people, don't tell anybody. Keep this a secret. I'm going to go someplace. I want to be alone. Why is this? Well, I really think that the emphasis here, and it shows up three times in our particular passage where he's telling people not to tell, he's in a remote place, whatever the case might be, where he's away from people. The emphasis is about not being premature in the mission and message of what this is all about. You know, it's one thing to heal somebody. It's one thing to raise the dead. It's another thing to die on the cross and rise again from the dead yourself. And that is the real message. And Jesus says, wait for it. That's coming. That's the major miracle. That's the thing you need to watch for and wait for. So the idea, of course, of showing the gospel is coming through Jesus' words even here. And of course, the fifth kind of recurring idea running through all of these stories is Jesus himself. Now, I was online this week interacting with folks like I usually do, and actually I was interacting with some folks that were discussing atheism. And what was fascinating about this is that we were having this great discussion about where is it that right and wrong comes from? What's the basis for our ethic, and where does that come from? And of course, if you are not a believer in God, then you believe that that comes from the individual or the community. But if you're a believer like I am, then I believe there's a transcendent source. So we were going back and forth about these ideas and these things. And that's what I want to say about this particular point about Jesus. The idea about being socially involved, that there is no social change unless there's internal change, which comes from an eternal source. I'll say that again. There is no social change unless it comes from an internal change. It comes from an eternal source. The social gospel is not a gospel without a theological foundation. The theology of this is what drives us. And all of the stories are about Jesus' exclusivity. And he's the one that's doing the miracles. And he's the one that is showing the gospel. Some of you know that we have a radio show once a week on Wednesdays from 10 until 12. And the theme of our radio show is do good, do good, do good. It's out of Titus chapter 3. And I always emphasize this to all of our guests and all of our listeners, that the do good only comes because of Titus chapter 2, 11 to 14. Looking for that blessed hope and the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. There is no good unless there is a change that takes place that comes from a transcendent source, and this is Jesus. Throughout the 80s and 90s, when I was teaching junior and senior high school, I used film clips constantly with classes, you know, 3 to 5 minute things, kind of energize the discussion process. And oh, by the way, I have to say, I really miss VHS tapes, man. You could just pop those babies in, you know, and they just go. You know, now you got to figure out everything and load it up. VHS, man. I just had a warm moment there, sorry. 3 episodes. Jesus is meeting human needs. Yes, there are miracles, but the miracle is behind the miracle. So let's notice these 3 events, these 3 episodes, this binge watching that we're doing. The first is the emphasis on human need of acceptance, the human need of acceptance. Did you know that Great Britain has a brand new minister? And this brand new minister, let me get her name right, her name is Tracy Crouch. She was just appointed because after some research, Great Britain discovered that over 9 million of their people in Great Britain are lonely. And I'm not kidding you, Great Britain now has a minister of loneliness. That's not a joke. I just read it in Time magazine. There's got to be truth to this thing, you know. The idea that a minister of loneliness in Great Britain. But that's not so far-fetched, quite frankly, because in another meeting with another student this week on the campus, she said to me with some of her friends, "All I want is somebody to listen to me." Gee, how about that? That sounds vaguely like Jesus. So when we see this first episode in our binge-watching moment here, we see these Jewish people who do not expect much from the Gentiles and the pagans. Well, let's just explode that, shall we? This idea comes out of 7:24 to 26, and you have here an explanation of a woman. Okay, pause there. Forgive me, ladies. Here you have a patriarchal society who won't accept women. And this is what the Jews are thinking when they're reading this thing and seeing this particular event. We don't accept a woman. Not only that, but she's Greek. And beyond that, she's high society. She's an elite. And beyond that, oh my word, she comes from Tyre and Sidon. Because you know who came from there? Jezebel. And you know what Jezebel did? She killed his Israelite prophets. And there was no love lost between the people in Galilee and the people in Tyre and Sidon. Boy, could Jesus have picked a worse person to do this with? And there it is, Jesus' mission. Yes, I come to the Jews first. When I was in high school, Romans chapter 1, 15 and 16, so as much as is in me, I'm ready to preach the gospel to the Jews first and also to the Gentiles. That was one of those things that I would repeat and rehearse regularly. And the idea, of course, is quite biblical. Obviously, Paul says it in Romans chapter 1, but the idea is that the message goes to the Jews first, but guess what? Also to the Gentiles. Let's not leave anybody out. And remember, we're all Gentiles here. So the idea, of course, is that this woman, who's a high society elite from an awful place as far as the Israelites were concerned, Tyre and Sidon, she has heard of him, first of all, and then she goes and falls at his feet. None of the Jewish leaders did this. Here you have a woman, pagan, elite, Greek, Syrophoenician, falling at Jesus' feet. Yes, Jesus did the miracle, cast out the demon. That was the other miracle, though, quite frankly, was who's the real Israelite here? I think it's the woman, because she actually understood Jesus' message. This is the problem, of course, when we label people and we ostracize them by our labeling and we marginalize people. We need to accept people as they are, as they come to us, because they're people. Well, then there's this thing that really gets people riled up. You know, this whole thing about the dogs. When Jesus refers to this woman as part of this group called the dogs, most people react violently to this. I mean, this is an awful, awful epithet that you would throw at somebody, right? Well, Jesus is using an accepted teaching practice. He's using metaphors, one after the other after the other. He talks about bread, children, and dogs. The bread is the gospel. The children, those are the Israelites, and the dogs are the Gentiles. And in the context, it's all about being around a family table. If you read the context of this passage closely, it's all about everybody sits down and the family dog is there and gets the scraps that fall on the floor. Now, just pause for a moment. All of those of you who have dogs at home, y'all know what this is like, right? Stuff falls off the table and before it hits the ground, it's gone. Well, that's what's going on in this particular passage. Jesus is accepting a woman whose faith is beyond compare, beyond anything that he's seen from the Jewish folks. She believed, as a matter of fact, there was no hesitation. She accepted it as done. The demon is gone. She knew it was going to be that way when she got home. Exactly that. The result for all of this is what I read from one person as holy chutzpah. Now, for those of you who don't do Hebrew or Yiddish, chutzpah simply means boldness. If we were in Great Britain, they would say, he's pretty cheeky. But in us, for us as Americans, we say, he's really got guts. She's really got guts. This is what she's got. Holy chutzpah. She's bold. With great humility, she comes, falls at Jesus' feet, but at the same time, acknowledges with bold entreaty what she wants. So I'm going to ask us this question. How do unbelievers come to truth? Unbelievers come to truth by what they see first, not by what you say first. Think about this. 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 2 says that you, speaking to Christians, are epistles in our day, emails, known and read of all men. 1 Thessalonians 4, 11 and 12 says that the way you're to attract outsiders, that is, unbelievers, is to do your job well, to write good academic papers, to play well on a sports team, to do good business practices, to participate in culture properly. Because when people see that, they say, man, there's something different going on here, and I got to know what that is. Jesus is showing the gospel. And he's showing us how to show the gospel. The second major episode here is this human need of wholeness. Now, I don't know if you're familiar or not. Let me fill us in on this. That there is a nationally primary place in the place of Indianapolis. In the city of Indianapolis. This is not true any other place in the nation. That's why I'm just agog at this. We have in Indianapolis the largest home for women who have been saved from human trafficking. It's called the Hope Center. Go down south, 465, cut over 52 east, 4 miles down the road, find the Hope Center. It's the largest facility in the nation to help women who have come out of sex trafficking. What hope there is in wholeness. Wholeness is to see the whole person saved, the whole person cared for. If you get an email from me, I quite often will say something like this, peace to you, or his peace to you. And by that, I don't mean some hippie-ish 1960s, let's flash the peace sign. What I mean by that is Hebrew shalom. Shalom means completion or wholeness. And I hope that for you when I sign off on an email. I hope that your life is whole in every way that it might be. Everybody wants that, don't they? Sure we do. And that's what Jesus brings. And so in his ministry, here you have all of these crowds that are gathering to Jesus. And they expect him to do tricks, to do this magician trip. But guess what? He doesn't do that. In fact, he does something altogether different. He takes the person and moves them into a private setting, according to the text. Moves them into a private setting. And let me say this about miracles. What's really interesting about miracles is that, you know, all the people that got healed and like Lazarus who got raised from the dead, guess what? They died. They died at some point. Okay, they're not still living, walking around, showing everybody their miracles. What was the point of the miracles but to point forward to that which is yet to come? This is what it was intended to be in the book of Genesis. This is what it will be in the book of Revelation. In fact, this is really cool. You got to flip over to Isaiah chapter 35 to check this out. Because in Isaiah chapter 35, it is predating what Jesus is saying. In fact, I think Mark and Peter, who was the author of this, got his info from Isaiah 35. Check this out. Here it is. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, verse 5. The ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. Man, that is cool. I love that. And this whole idea of something that is yet to come. In fact, if you examine Isaiah 35, guess where it takes place? He's speaking to a group in Lebanon. Right where, guess what? Tyre and Sidon are. Guess where Jesus is? Tyre and Sidon. Guess what he's referring to? Lebanon from Isaiah chapter 35. People think the Bible doesn't fit together. Give me a break. Then there's the method, of course. Now, quite frankly, the whole spitting thing is turning us off. Okay? Let's just be real honest with each other. Jesus spits and then puts his hand with the spittle on it on the man's tongue to heal him. All right, let's just admit right now that that's just gross and it grosses us out. So I got permission from Robin, my wife, to tell this story because when she was younger, she has an older brother, and he would hold her down on the ground and then create a giant loogie and let it drop just in front of her face and then suck it back up again. I know. See, exactly right. I feel the same way. Oh, why do they let you preach anyway? I mean, you tell us awful stuff like that. Yeah, spitting is not cool, man. It's not a, you spit in somebody's face, that's an awful thing. But in this case, in the ancient world in the first century, guess what's happening? You got people in the first century who are esteemed people. And as far as some were concerned, these esteemed people could then use their spittle as a medicinal element. It was an accepted practice by those who were viewed as esteemed elite miracle workers. And that's what Jesus is doing. He is using this to highlight what's going on. In fact, the word there that's used is really cool. When his tongue was loosened, it says, the original language word is this chain was broken. He was chained or enslaved. His tongue was chained, but now he's not any longer. His tongue is loosened. He no longer has a speech impediment. And what's the result to all of this? The result is that people were astonished. The word literally means to be absolutely overwhelmed. I can't get over this, all the crowd is saying. So how do we show the gospel? How do we emphasize the future? How do we talk about how things ought to be? How do we see Revelation 5, 7, 9, and 10, where we have all different folks from all different places, all one in Christ? I mentioned the radio show just a moment ago, and one of the things that we do on Wednesday mornings, one of the purposes of our show at Comenius, is to bring black and white leaders together. That's one of our purposes. And one of the great things that's just happened is that Dr. Clyde Posley, from Antioch Baptist Church, has now joined me as co-host of this program. And I'm so pleased about this, because now he and I are going to share these duties, but we look in each other's eyes, we come from the same biblical authority, and we both say that the time has come and long past when people ought to come together as one. So the showing of the gospel, it might be different for you. You might do it in a different way. These are just some examples of what's happening around Indianapolis. And then there's the human need of satisfaction. And here's this, the feeding of the 4,000. Now, I got to tell you that, to be real honest, you know, we just got done with Christmas, and it was really cool to go see the grandkids, you know, and the house is all decorated, and they're all excited and up early, and they couldn't wait to get the pictures taken so that they could start opening presents and all that kind of stuff. You know how many decorations Robin and I put up this year? Zero. None. This is how the conversation went, something like this. Do you want to get the boxes out of the crawl space? No, I don't want to get the crawl. Do you want to get? No. We're going to see the kids. Yeah, that's good. All right. Look, for those of us who have been through Christmas, okay, in my case, 60 of them. It's old hat, baby. There's nothing new. But for my little grandkids, whoa. I mean, hair on fire. It's great. It's cool. It's new. And here's what I want to say about satisfaction. Beware that the gospel doesn't become boring to you. That you continue to unpack the boxes from the crawl space and bring the decorations out. Because the satisfaction issue is pretty important, pretty huge. These folks, these Gentile people, had come and gathered to Jesus. They, by their own volition and intention, came to Jesus. This is pretty cool that they did this. But then his mercy kicks in. Now, for 3 days, they'd been listening to him. Now, once again, no teaching, no telling, all showing. For 3 days, and the word that Jesus uses, he says, I have compassion on these people. Now, that word compassion is a word that literally means guts. I mean, it's the intestines. That's where the word comes from. And it is this concept of gut-wrenching emotion. And what's really cool about this word is that it wasn't used for close friends. It was used in Mark 1:41 for lepers. It was used in 6:34 for revolutionaries. It was used in our passage for Gentiles, and then in 9:22 for those demon-possessed. Who should we have compassion for? Those who aren't like us. So, how do we show mercy to the least of these? We have some great social outreach going on through this particular community, through this church. One of which we just heard from Pat Hatch. Thank you, Pat, for your explanation of international students and the emphasis that can be ours now in reaching out to internationals. This is a fantastic opportunity and one that we should be involved in and invested in as you've been gifted and have an opportunity to do so. These are the kinds of things that outreach and give mercy and show compassion to others. And then there's this meal, though. Where does this satisfaction come from? Now, I have to tell you that every once in a while, the English versions of God's Word don't quite capture the fullness. So in 8:4, when the disciples say, there is no food here to feed the people, in the original language, it says, there's nothing here to satisfy them. The word in 8:4 is the same word in 8:8, which says, and Jesus, having fed them, they were satisfied. Isn't that interesting? And we come back to the same concept again, that only through Jesus does this stuff get done. And that the meal is one simply to demonstrate that the satisfaction comes through Jesus. And what's the result of this? There's leftovers. Now, I don't know, some of you screw up your faces when I say leftovers because you don't like leftovers. I love leftovers. They're great because I don't have to cook. It's good. Leftovers. Notice the text says 7 baskets. Now, we're not talking about that little basket, nice little basket, you know, you put on your coffee table. We're talking about a man-sized basket. The same word that's used here in Mark is the word used in Acts chapter 9 when they let Paul down out of the city over the wall in a basket. Paul ain't coming down out of that wall and your little trinket on the coffee table. It's a man-sized basket full of leftovers. And not just that. There is this emphasis of this result that he sent them away. That word Jesus chose very, very carefully. The word means that they were now liberated. Jesus has liberated them. He has left them satisfied. We have a sister church down here in the city, Redeemer Presbyterian. I'm sure many of you know about it. And one of the things that's true about Redeemer Presbyterian is that they have created some years back what's referred to now as the Harrison Center for the Arts. And it's a really cool place. If you ever get to go and see Joanna Taft and all the great things that are going on there down at First Fridays in the city at Redeemer, but it's through Harrison Center for the Arts, fantastic stuff. What is Harrison Center doing? They are attracting people to the gospel through art. They are showing the gospel through people who paint and create sculptures. When I think about that famous triad, for those of you who might know a little bit about this truth, goodness, and beauty, maybe you've heard that three-word phrase before, I've been telling people, you know, we need to flip that around. We need to start with beauty. You need to show people beauty. You need to demonstrate good. And then maybe, just maybe, they'll want to hear your truth. But they are not going to want to hear your truth unless you've shown them some beauty and done some good. And that is what showing the gospel is all about. And that is what Jesus does. Now, all of these results taken together are really pretty interesting as well. All of these results are new and exciting. The kid waking up on Christmas morning kind of thing. Because what's happening in the next passage, in chapter 8 and verse 11, what do we find? We're back with the Pharisees again. Jesus did his 120-mile trek, went across the lake, back with the Pharisees. And you want to know what the Pharisees wanted? They wanted a sign. Show us a sign. We're not really sure that you're the one. We don't know that you're the man. Show us a sign. Jesus was with the Gentiles. The woman comes and falls at his feet. The people were gathered to eat his food. All of this young man who couldn't speak was healed. All Gentiles. And now, the people that should have known better want a sign. The results all come to the same point. And the same point is that we have a tendency to be nearsighted. It's called myopia, for those of you who are the ophthalmologists in the group. What happens to your eyes when you can read something really good here, but you can't see anything far away? And that was the Jewish problem, and that sometimes is our problem. When we get so consumed with what's right in front of us and we don't see the big picture, the future yet to come, the hope, the anticipation of Jesus' return, what the church should look like then and will look like then, should look like that now, and this is what we need to work toward. Now, I don't know if you'll be surprised at this or not, but I really enjoy talking with atheists. And if you know me at all, you've heard some of my stories about teaching in high school, bringing atheists into my classroom, and having, as I always told my students, the opportunity for them to hear somebody who believes what they believe from themselves, not filtered through Mark. So this last week, I was invested, as I suggested early on, with some discussions with atheists and others who were sympathetic to this. And I watched a couple of YouTube presentations from an atheist. And one of them was this man who was emphasizing the fact that God exists is implausible. It can't happen. But he said, let's not lose what the Christian religionists all around us all have. And he said, now if you go to any black Pentecostal church, this is what you're going to hear. Praise Jesus! Bring it now! Come on! Preach! And what's really funny is that the atheist on the YouTube says, well, why can't we do that? Praise Plato! Praise Shakespeare! Praise Aristotle! He got the general sense of the emotive quality here, but I think the source was wrong. But then there was always the issue of transcendence. You know, there's an external source for all of this. Where does that come from? And in another video from the same man I watched, as he said, we know that there is no God. And these are his words, but we long for something that is transcendent. We long for a source outside of ourselves. He then went to discuss the issue of creation, but tears filled my eyes for this man. Because as much as he is absolutely right about the need for transcendence, the source only comes from one place, and that is from Jesus who died on the cross, rose again from the dead and lives for us today and will come back to establish his church, which will look like it should look now. in a way that shows the gospel to people. When you have an opportunity to show the gospel, 2 Corinthians 3:2, be an epistle, an email, known and read of all men. 1 Thessalonians 4:11 and 12, be such a great worker that people look at this and you draw outsiders to yourself. So that by showing the gospel, you may at some point have an opportunity to share that gospel. Lord, help us in this regard. Make us understand our responsibility. Make us know that our first responsibility in a culture of need, in want, of satisfaction, of affection, strewn with loneliness, who desperately wants to hear a word, help us, Lord, to be that word, to be that physical presence, and to honor your word by showing the gospel as you did in your day to the Gentiles in these episodes from the Gospel of Mark. We are grateful for the opportunities of this church and of this day, the lives you've given to us. Help us, Lord, to demonstrate over and over and over again the gospel through our actions so that we might have an opportunity to tell them about Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen.